Okay, so how many people do not understand Polish? Okay, quite a lot. So, first about trusted computing. This is the subject of today's lecture. My name is Joanna Rutkowska. I'm a founder and CEO of Invisible Things Lab. And this is our fearless team. So, Alexander Tereshkin and Rafał Wojczuk. And this is some of our recent research. Invisible Things Lab is a small security research company, and we focus on the technology and on the core technology, the very low-level technology. And as you can see, we did some work in this area. We mostly focus on seeing how good this technology is. We sometimes demonstrate that it's not really as good as it should be. So Visa kernel protection bypasses 2 years ago, blue pill with nested matrices, then hypervisor compromises last year, some Intel CPU privilege escalation work just a few months ago, and Intel TXT trusted execution technology bypass just a few months ago. And today I'm going to talk about three things. It's going to be basic building blocks that are the actual technology used for building trusted computing. The basic building blocks that are available in pretty much any laptop that we can buy today in shops. Then we're going to discuss practical examples of trusted computing. And finally, we're going to confront theory versus reality. So we're going to mention some of the recent attacks against those technologies. So trusted computing. Well, the goal of trusted computing is to make desktop computers more secure. And solution to do this is to use a hardware, which is important word here, a hardware element that would be embedded in our laptop or our desktop computer, and this hardware element will be responsible for somehow checking all or some of the software running on the platform. And of course, we require that the software somehow must be trusted computing aware to take advantage of this, of those all new technologies that we're going to discuss in a moment. Because of course, just the fact that we buy a brand new laptop with TXT, VT, and TPM doesn't automatically make the software running there more secure if the software is not designed to exploit those new technologies. And trusted computing group .org, you can go there and download some spec. And members and founders include such brands as AMD, Intel, IBM, Microsoft, Sun, Lenovo, HP, and some 20 more probably. So basic building blocks. There are three basic building blocks that we're going to discuss today. And the first one is trusted platform module. So trusted platform module is this hardware element that I just mentioned before that is responsible for somehow checking the state of the platform. So it's the very core of any kind of trusted computing. So we're going to discuss TXT in a moment, and TXT is building also, or is using TPM. TPM 1.2, this is what we use today. And what we need to know about TPM is it's a passive device, passive I/O device. The passive, I'm stressing the word passive, it means that the device itself cannot do much without our initiative, it cannot do much by itself. It can only respond our queries. And it has special registers, PCR, at least 24 of them. And it has some interesting operations that we're going to discuss in a moment. That would be seal, unseal, quad. And it also offers some crypto service, some standard crypto services like random number generation and RSI key generation and stuff like that. So PCR registers, this is the most important part of the TPM. 24 registers, each can hold a 160-bit value. 160-bit is the length of the SHA-1 hash function. And this is not accidental, because PCR registers have this very interesting property that we cannot actually write to a PCR register, so we cannot write 1, 2, 3, 4 to a PCR 0. We can only extend PCR registers. Extend operation is illustrated here. So if the PCR register has some value right now, PCR n, and if we want to extend it with a new value, this value, the actual new value that will be assigned to this register will be SHA-1 of concatenation of those two values. This is done this way because we want some properties. And first property we want is that because of that we can have infinite number of, we can write to a given PCR infinite number of times. We can extend it, extend it, extend it. That's obvious. Also, it's computationally infeasible to set PCR to a given value. So I can extend it with 001, 002, one after each other. And this will result in PCR having some 160-bit hash value. But if I wanted to directly assign this 160-bit value to this PCR, that would require for me to break SHA-1, which is at least today it's computationally infeasible. And we're gonna see an example why this is so important just in a moment. And of course, there's also another property, which is that we extend with value a first and then with value b. The resulting value of a PCR will not be the same as if we first extend it with b and then with a. Maybe not so trivial, but you can intuitively feel that this should hold. So the most basic application is to implement static root of trust measurement. And in fact, this is what we have in BitLocker. So imagine we have TPM on our laptop. And this TPM has a number of PCR registers. For this example, it's actually not important that we have 5 registers, we could just have 1, doesn't really matter. What matters is that once we start the computer, well, the very first code that executes is some very core part of the BIOS. It's maybe not really true, but let's say it's true. So, this is how this is usually presented. So, from the system programmer's point of view, this is true. So some core BIOS code is executed first. This is also called CRTM, which is core root of trust for measurement. So this BIOS, well, usually has some second stage BIOS, which is the whole big BIOS that has several megabytes of size and that is flashable. This one should be immutable. It should be in read-only memory, the real read-only memory, not possible to reflash. So what this guy does is it calculates hash of this next element, this next stage of the code that will be run in a moment, and extends PCR 0 and 1 in this example. This is just a convention. Extends those PCR registers with the value of this hash. This is called that this guy is measuring this guy and puts the result of the measuring, so the hash of the code, into a PCR register. And only then it transfers execution to this next stage of execution. There are two arrows here because in PCR 0 there is hash of code and PCR 1 there is a chipset config. But this is just a technicality, not important. So important thing is it transfers execution, it jumps to this code no matter what the result here was. It always jumps there. You shouldn't laugh though, because of course this could be evil code. But we will see that it's okay. So then the BIOS flash executes, and BIOS flash flash measures some PCI ROMs if they are present, puts the value in some other PCI registers. It could very well put in the same those measurements into the same register. Doesn't matter. And then then we have some bootloader. So again, bias flush measures the bootloader before jumping there, puts the hash in the register and jumps to the bootloader, etc. This is the by convention the BIOSes and bootloaders should use those PCR for storing those hashes. This is really not important. So why is actually why putting those measurements into PCRs is so important and is so breakthrough? Because of the seal and quad operations that the TPM provides. The seal operation and unseal operation works this way. We have a TPM, and let's say that at some moment we got to the point that some set of PCR registers are set to some value. Well, whatever. These are 17, 18, 19. Let's say these are 0, 1, 2. So these are the results of measuring of this booting process. And now we can ask TPM to do seal operation for us, which without going into the actual details how it is implemented, because this is not important for us today. The seal operation somehow automatically makes it that TPM takes a snapshot of those PCR registers, and then in the future, if we want to unseal this something, this usually it will be a key, a crypto key. In the future, when we want to unseal this crypto key, TPM will allow us to, or will provide us with this key only and only if those PCR registers are the same, have the same value as they had during the sealing operation. And you immediately can see now that, remember this picture from just 1 minute ago when we had the boot process that put in PCR 0 something, PCR 1 something, etc. So now we see that if we booted a platform and with a given software, this version of BIOS, this version of PCI EEPROMs, this version of bootloader, this version of Linux kernel or Windows kernel, it resulted in some specific values being, or in PCR registers having some specific values, being result of measuring all those code components. And only those values, and only those specific components, this BIOS version, this PCI EEPROMs code, this OS loader, this various kernel version, only those specific versions will result in those specific PCR values. So if we have put disk encryption key, for example, if we sealed disk encryption key with those values, we can be sure that the next time we turn on our computer, only if all the same code components will be executed at startup, only then the PCR registers will get the same values as they were when we seal it, and only then we will be able, or the actual decryption software will be able to unseal the disk decryption key, and we'll be able to proceed with further decrypting our root file system and home directory and everything else. TPM quad operation is somehow similar to seal, but this is what we use in a remote scenario. So TPM quad operation, we can have TPM to report, usually to some remote entity, for example, to a corporate server, to remote that the TPM has those values at its PCRs. The whole point here is that TPM, let's say it generates packet which is digitally signed with something which is called attestation identity key, I think is the name. And only TPM knows this key. So we can imagine that we set up a corporate network, and every employee gets its TPM initialized, gets AI key generated there, and there is some server in a corporation, and the server will allow a client to connect to a corporate network only if the client was booted with the known software, which means that the PCRs had some specific value, and the server can know this because the server will get this signed report from the TPM that the PCR values, well, something. And if they match what the server expects, it allows the connection, for example. Again, let me stress that TPM is a passive device. It doesn't do anything by itself. It's a client-server model. We send a seal request, it returns something. We sell quad command, it returns the signed packet. It doesn't have a DMA engine, so it cannot access host memory. Building block number two is Intel Trusted Execution Technology. And Intel Trusted Execution Technology is basically about implementing dynamic root of trust for measurement. What we saw previously was static root of trust for measurement. I will discuss in a moment why it is dynamic. So the most important thing that TXT brings is a new, well, it's a bunch of new instructions, but the most important one is SEnter. So when you buy a computer that has TXT support, it will have a CPU that has those new TXT instructions, like five instructions probably. It will also have a chipset with TXT and VTD support, but we're going to discuss it just in a moment. So, what does TXT or SEnter or DRTM is all about? Imagine we have it's a system. It's a memory. We see lots of bugs and rootkits and viruses living there, right? And let's say we loaded somehow a candidate for a VMM. A VMM is a virtual machine monitor. This is usually how the spec refers to this code. This could also be just a Linux kernel or a Windows kernel, or it could be, a VMM is a hypervisor, so it could be a Xen hypervisor. And anyway, this is just some code, some system core code that we would like to load. Kernel or hypervisor. So now let's say we loaded this code, and now we have it in memory, and now we want to start it. But we want to start it, and we want to make sure that all those viruses and rootkits and God knows what else does not infect it. So we have this SEnter instruction, which automatically takes the address of this VMM code and automatically loads it, which means basically think about jump to this code and starts executing it. However, in the meantime, it applies special protection around this code, which would be a memory protection that protects this code against further modifications. But of course, you might be asking yourself, okay, but what if, because we expect that SEnter will somehow verify this VMM before applying the protection and jumping there. So what if those viruses will infect the VMM just before it got loaded? Well, and here's how TPM comes with help. For TXT, we have this PCR18 register. There's no special reason why this is 18, just a convention. So the trick is that SEnter first applies this protection around memory, then it hashes the code, it also freezes the CPUs. So all the other CPUs besides the CPU on which we started, or on which we executed a center, are basically frozen or put into sleep mode. The memory protection is applied. Then as enter measures the VMM, so calculates a hash, puts the hash into PCR18, or more precisely extend PCR18 with this hash, and then jumps to VMM. And again, notice that I said, and then it jumps to the VMM, and I didn't say it jumps to the VMM only if the PCR is okay. No, whatever the PCR value here, whatever the hash value was, the S-enter will always execute VMM. Potentially, it might have been a compromised VMM. It still will get executed. However, the point is that only if this PCR18 has a correct value, only then TPM will be able to unseal key for this VMM once it starts executing. So if those viruses and bugs and whatever here compromised VMM just before a sender, and if a sender loaded it compromised, we would have wrong value here. Wrong value would result that this just loaded VMM, it will start executing, but it will be unable to obtain any valid keys from the TPM. So for example, it would be unable to decrypt the whole file system. Important thing, S-enter will not block loading of anything. S-enter is also not obligatory, so we might very well not execute S-enter at all. So TXT and TPM, they cannot enforce anything on our hardware. They cannot forbid us from running Linux on our laptop. We can run whatever we want. So if a center is obligatory and also loads this unrestricted code, so what is this all for? Again, this is all for this. The whole point is, because why would a user be interested in executing a center or the attacker? Because it's all about those secrets stored in the TPM. Because without those secrets, the assumption is the compromised hypervisor, the compromised kernel, will not be able to decrypt the disk, will not be able to connect to the corporate network or do something else. Okay, why we have DRTM if we just had SRTM? And SRTM sounded just equally good and much more simple. In fact, SRTM, the standard TPM, the static root of trust, is much simpler. TXT is dramatically complex technology. Still, why we have it? We have it because there are problems with maintaining static root of trust. The biggest problem is completeness. Completeness is illustrated here. Remember this booting process. And now imagine what would happen if, say, this BIOS stage 2, what if it forgot about measuring optional PCI EPROMs? PCI EPROMs code is something when we have a PCI card in a computer, PCI card can have a optional initialization code that the BIOS should execute during the boot process. So, for example, imagine that the BIOS was written in a buggy way and it forgot about hashing this. That would be, there would be the complete failure of this whole static root of trust boot process, because since now on we could start loading something totally different, but at the same time now, because we would control those all this software here, we would be able to still put original values into PCRs. So we would be able to simulate the process if we loaded correct software, but at the same time, we would be loading the incorrect software. Normally, we cannot do that. Normally, we cannot do that because once we, if this handed out execution to bootloader that was infected red, this red one, the hash of this red one would be already in the PCR. And this extend operation with this wrong hash is irreversible. Here, we don't have this problem because we haven't measured it here. So we can transfer execution to some alternative bootloader, but can put a hash of this original one. So that's a problem with static root of trust, maintaining the chain of trust. And that's why we have DRTM, because in DRTM, we don't care what the state of the system is. Remember this picture with all the bugs and butterflies and everything, and doesn't matter, it could be infected. We have this sender instruction, takes the VMM, automatically protects it and loves it. So in TXT, the assumption is we don't care if the BIOS was compromised, if some PCI EEPROMs were compromised, if the loader was compromised. We don't care. That's why it's so good. Of course, in practice, this is not really the case, as you will see at the end of the presentation, but in theory, at least. So the last building block is the virtualization technology. So virtualization technology, it's more than just those two, but these are the most important. VTX, this is the CPU virtualization. So the actual intercepts on the CPU. So Blue Pill, for example, was using VTX and AMDV as well. And VTD is virtualization for devices. And this is also known as IOMMU. VTD is crucial for TXT because of the DMA attacks. And again, we have this VMM that has just been loaded. And you, before I use this black frame around VMM to symbolize that it's protected against any memory attacks. And this is in fact where we use VTD, because if we didn't have VTD, we could have some device setting up a DMA transaction from PCI bus to this memory region, and this could just compromise VMM after the hash was calculated, which would be fatal. So VTD is a way to protect memory, system memory, against devices. Of course, we don't have to assume devices to be malicious to do malicious DMA, because devices can be programmed by software. So if there is some malicious software, it can program device to do DMA to this device. We showed some example DMA attacks last year and at our Zen Owning trilogy, by the way. So trusted computing technology, three building blocks, TPM, TXT, VTD. This is for Intel. On AMD, we have Presidio, which is more or less the same as TXT, and IOMMU, which is more or less the same as VTD. There are some differences. There are huge implementation differences, so the code is incompatible on binary level, but conceptually, these are very similar technologies. I focus on Intel because most of the computers on the market are Intel. And in fact, it's quite difficult to even buy a laptop with AMD technology. That's why I'm ignoring AMD technologies in today's presentation. So, examples of trusted computing. If you might. So, probably many of you are decent paranoid users and you use disk encryption. How many people use disk encryptions on your laptops? Good. So you feel secure, right? At least from against a thief stealing it from your hotel room. But you probably haven't thought about if you might that could use this very simple scenario, which is you're leaving your laptop in a hotel room. Well, this could happen because you just went to a swimming pool, right? Or to the spa. You're not gonna bring your laptop with you to the swimming pool, will you? So, let's assume there are some situations where your laptop is left in a room. So the evil mind sneaks in and boots laptop from the evil USB, and the USB infects MBR on your laptop, with example blue pill boot that we released last year. Operating time 3 minutes, she can do this while cleaning your bathroom, and this is not suspected because she has a right to be in your room. So you come back to your room, to your room, after the swimming pool or whatever, and as usually, open your laptop and enter your passphrase, pin, whatever. Blue pill boot sniffs the decryption because first the infected MBR will start the blue pill boot, which will sniff the decryption key and saves it somewhere. It could be the encrypted partition. If you're using BitLocker, you need to have a boot partition. But pretty much any disk encryption software, TrueCrypt, has some unencrypted, at least 63 unencrypted sectors on your disk. If you use Lux for Linux, you usually have boot partition that is unencrypted, so it can store the password at one of the unencrypted sectors, for example, or it can allow the system to boot and transmit the sniffed passphrase or decryption key over the network. And then if you might come in the evening and just steals your laptop, because she now has the key and can decrypt the laptop. If you're using one of those fancy RSA token IDs, whatever, doesn't really change anything, because blue pill boot in this example can sniff the actual decryption key that will be generated after you insert your token, enter your one-time password, whatever. It will eventually get access to this decryption key. You don't really have to use blue pill boot. I just use blue pill boot because this is probably the more fancy and elegant way of doing this. You can pretty much get away with traditional BIOS-based MBR infection. There were some projects like EI Bootroot. You can use probably software like that to do that as well. Again, this is trivial attack for the Mate. This is very practical. As I said, you just boot the computer from the USB stick, just 3 minutes, counting, entering, and leaving the room. So have you ever left your laptop unattended? And I guess she did, right? So how TPM can help? It can help because it can provide this trusted boot. So with TPM, and this is the scenario that is used on BitLocker actually. So we have disk encrypted with some key, and that key is sealed into the TPM, which means the TPM will unseal the key, will allow the software to get this key only and only if the values of PCI registers will be the same as they were during the sealing process. And the sealing process took place when you encrypted your laptop. Now, only if the correct software, this is what I just said, it gets started. So, this means correct correct master boot record was executed. Only then you will get possibility for the BitLocker to extract the actual key. So if you had this evil mate attack here, so you had BitLocker, but the evil mate infected your MBR, for example, or BIOS, whatever, and S infection is a disease, by the way, but let's say MBR. So infected MBR, and your evil code got started, and then only BitLocker got started. BitLocker will not be able to extract the key because the PCR values will be wrong. They will be wrong because the BIOS, before handing execution to MBR, will measure the MBR, and the hash will be incorrect because MBR will be infected. But everything, all the evil might should do in this scenario is the infected MBR should display a fake BitLocker, for example, a password or PIN prompt that just mimics the original one. And then you, of course, enter your PIN, because for BitLocker there are PINs, not passphrases. And then again, it gets the PIN, it's happy, it stores the PIN somewhere or transmits it over a network. But of course, at this time, the evil loader, the evil fake BitLocker prompt, cannot just hand execution to original BitLocker and decrypt the system. This time, this will not succeed because the PCR values are wrong. So this time, the BitLocker what should do? It should report, oh, your PIN is wrong, whatever, rebooting. I don't remember, it's been a while since I've been using BitLocker, but I think after a few wrong passwords, it locks the system and need to reboot. So, the lesson from this is that a really paranoid user should refuse. Oh, I see now that I've written it wrongly. Because once you realize that you entered your password, and it still says it is a wrong password, and rebooted your system, you can be pretty sure that it was a fake BitLocker, and your password has been just stored somewhere. So what a really paranoid user should do in this case is just destroy his or her laptop. I need to correct it. Or we can imagine somehow more sophisticated scenario, also using TPM. This is all TPM, not TXT, just static root of trust. So this would be a user's picture test, as I call it. And this work this way. During the installation or the encryption process, when you set up BitLocker or whatever, you take a picture of yourself using the built-in camera. Every laptop has a built-in camera these days, right? So the picture now is stored on disk, encrypted with some key, K-picture, and this key is sealed into the TPM. And now, on each reboot, on each process boot, we expect that the disk encryption software, when it displays its prompt for passphrase or PIN or password, that it displays your picture on the screen. We know that it will be able to retrieve this secret, this key that was used to encrypt this BMP file or JPEG file, only if the system was not infected. So if we see our picture on the screen, we can be pretty sure that it's the original BitLocker or TrueCrypt or whatever asking us for a passphrase. Oh, the question was, can we use the photo of the laptop owner? Because I imagine you're thinking that somebody might just spoof your picture. But the whole point is, okay, because the alternative way would be just to use a sentence, right? Like, this is my secret sentence, and it will be displayed only, again, it will be encrypted, and the key will be sealed into TPM, and it will be displayed only if the correct software got booted. But the whole point is that this will be trivial to somehow to notice the sentence. The evil mate will sneak into the room, turn on the computer, will see the sentence, will write it down, will come back next day with the fake BitLocker prompt software that would be displaying the same sentence, and it would be worthless. The whole point is that when we see a picture, well, even if she take a picture of this picture, it wouldn't be the same quality, and we somehow expect that the human eye would be able to recognize, well, this is not my picture. Or even if it was the same picture of me, again, I would recognize this is not the same picture, different angle, different lighting, right? The point is, this could be a picture of anything, of my favorite pet, whatever. The point is, it's not easy to copy it by using a camera or something like that. And of course, after the user accepts the picture and enters the passphrase, the software should extend PCR with some value, example 0 or 1, whatever, to lock access to this key against malware. This is what we just discussed. Okay, but you say not a big deal. I mean, come on, we have hardware keyboard sniffers. We can have hidden camera in our room. Or we can have electromagnetic leak, whatever. Sure, true. I would argue that hardware keyboard sniffers are probably not feasible if you have a decently designed laptop, like Apple laptop probably. I would expect there are there are not many spies inside. Like, imagine, I'm not using Air here, but imagine using Apple MacBook Air. MacBook Air is so thin. Where would you fit a hardware keyboard sniffer there? I mean, if it was more space there, they would probably use it for putting bigger disk or bigger battery or whatever. So laptops, especially compact, well-designed laptops, are so packed inside that it's probably not feasible to put a sniffer there, keystroke sniffer. It's a matter of what? Well, okay, but it's like orders of magnitude much more complicated than the evil made attack that I just presented you. That just inserts USB stick, infects MBR. It's just trivial. Of course, you can try to protect against those using solutions like key files or tokens, which are now useful. So key files or tokens or one-time passwords are useful against those keystroke sniffing. Of course, there is still this problem of, well, you can just read it. I'm sorry? Say it again. Where's alternative text? Oh, okay, this yellow one when you... Okay, sorry. Well, sorry, there is missing one. I even don't remember what was that, so it was like... Actually, what would happen would be something like...
This is an area called the UI integration.
I guess so, yes. Okay, example number 2. Chinese hardware backdoors. How many laptops or parts of laptops or components are made in China? And of course, substitute China with your favorite evil country. Are you afraid of malicious vendors? Are you like a made in China PCA based backdoor? In fact, lots of people are. Like, especially in the US. Like, I remember when Lenovo bought IBM the ThinkPad. The ThinkPad laptop, the ThinkPad brand. There are like lots of people in the U.S. who are saying something like, "Oh, now Chinese will build all the backdoors into those ThinkPads, and like the U.S. government will have to switch to some other brand or whatever." I'm really not a specialist to discuss whether it's really feasible from the economic and strategic point of view. From technology point of view, it's certainly possible. This is how a typical computer system looks like. a CPU, a node bridge, a salt bridge, three main components. And well, this is where usually memory connects. On the recent Core i7, we have actually memory connected directly to the processor because part of the node bridge, the memory controller, is in the CPU, but it's not important. Graphics, that usually is implemented, especially on laptops, with the node bridge. And we have salt bridge, with that is the connection to most of the components. We have PCI buses here, Wi-Fi, network cards, disk controllers, FireWire, USB controllers, etc. In many cases, the salt bridge will already contain some of those controllers integrated. The whole point here is that pretty much any device that, well, any device that is on PCI bus or PCI Express bus is equipped with a DMA engine, which means that any of these devices can access any system memory. This is how DMA works, and this is how our systems were designed. And this, by the way, is the reason why all the operating systems we know, Windows, Linux, Mac, why all those systems use only two rings, ring 0 and ring 3, just because even if they use more than two rings, if they put drivers into ring 1 for separation, that wouldn't help, because device drivers would be able to still program devices to do DMA to the kernel area. So there would be no benefit of moving drivers to ring 1. So how trusted computing comes into play? Well, this is what I said before, that when we buy a computer that is TXT and DVT compatible, it will have a bunch of extensions. First, in the CPU, we have those TXT extensions that are those new instructions, including SEnter instruction, VTX, which is the CPU virtualization, some little bit of TXT node bridge, and VTD. VTD, oh, of course, TPM. TPM on today's platforms is not a discrete component, it's usually integrated into the salt bridge. That has some consequences that we're going to discuss later. So VTD is important here, because VTD is a filter that can be programmed to disallow DMAs to certain memory regions from certain devices. VTD is all about blocking DMA. Okay, this is not true. VMA is all about blocking and also remapping. This has benefits for virtualization, when we can allow some virtual machines to do direct DMA, but only to certain memory regions that are owned by specific virtual machine and not by other VMs or a hypervisor. So this is how the evil DMA how it looks like. So we have some driver in the operating system, programs device, and device accesses some memory in the kernel, for example. And VTD, this is an example from Zen. As a Zen, it's ring 0 because this is a PV guest, not HVM guest, but it's not important. Here is a VDD, and again, if you program a device to do DMA to some memory that we don't want it to do DMA to, it will be blocked by VDD. So we can have a network card assigned only to some, here you see, to some virtual machine, because this is, again, picture from Zen, or we can just assign all the PCI devices to specific regions in memory. So even if Chinese guys put backdoors here, they'll not be able to modify hypervisors anything else beside the region assigned to the driver for this car. Of course, you might argue that this is still a lot, because having a backdoor in the network card can allow them to do sniffing or many of the middle attacks. And of course, here my response would be that then you should use proper network protocols like SSL, HTTPS that would protect against such attacks, VPN and stuff like that. And the same for disk. Imagine this is a disk controller. And imagine they put a backdoor into the disk controller. Again, using VTD, we can allow this disk controller to only talk to the memory that's owned by the disk driver software and nothing else. And again, if we use encrypted disk on sector level encrypted, I'm sorry, then they cannot gain much, because, well, of course they can sniff the traffic, but this all the traffic will be encrypted. And the actual decryption driver will be here. So they cannot modify it, they cannot sniff it. They can only do DOS, which is silly in that case. A malicious firmware, again, usually to the SoundBridge we have also SPS flash connected. SPS flash is the actual little chip which has a capacity of, say, 8 megabytes. This is the actual flash where the firmware is stored, like BIOS firmware or some other interesting firmware. Again, we can expect that if we buy a laptop from untrusted vendor, they might have flashed it with some buggy BIOS. But we shall fear it not, because we have this DRTM and TXT. Again, TXT is help here because it doesn't rely, should not rely, on the state of the BIOS. If we wanted to rely only on the static root of trust that we discussed at the beginning, that would be a problem, because if the malicious vendor have put it infected BIOS, infected core root of trust CRTM, that will be the failure of the static root of trust. Using TXT, we should not be afraid of this. We don't care about the state of the system before we execute sEnter. So the conclusion is, VTD and TXT offer a potential to protect against potentially malicious hardware. And let me repeat it, because this is quite an important conclusion, that VTD and TXT offer a potential for protection against potentially malicious hardware, which is quite something. Except, of course, for a potentially malicious CPU and the chipset. CPU and the chipset usually are made by Intel or AMD. In those new Core i7 processors, as I said, the memory controller is integrated into the processor, so we just have to trust the processor, because the VTD component is in the processor then. So shall we trust Intel or AMD? And that's, of course, an open question, because building a backdoor into a processor is trivial. We can think of dozens of ways how to do that if we were Intel or AMD. Just an example of a local backdoor, that I call it local enable of privilege escalation. So the process would just, if it happened that one register and RAX and RCX contained some magic 64-bit values, then jump to some value in RBX. This little backdoor could allow us to write privilege escalations on pretty much any operating system we can think of. And we can also come up with some more complex scenarios for remote escalation backs. This is just a few more gates on the processor that already has like a few hundreds of millions of gates? And how many people you think can reverse engineer a processor? It's funny how you can read that European governments are afraid of using Windows because it's a closed source software, and maybe we should not trust closed source software because there might be bugs or backdoors there. Maybe we should switch to Linux, which is open source, and everybody can see what's there. But again, building in a backdoor for Microsoft is like orders of magnitude much more difficult, much more risky than for Intel, because like hundreds of very skilled researchers, they look at Windows code every day. If there is a backdoor there, they will eventually find it. It's really, really a very high sophisticated art to build a backdoor, reliable backdoor into, let's say, Windows, and to make it look like not a backdoor, but just an accidental bug. For Intel and AMD, who will open the processor, who will reverse it? How many people have electron microscope? And even if you have, there are so hundreds of millions of transistors there, how are you gonna reverse engineer it? Chances are zero, you will find it. The other question is, of course, whether Intel or AMD would be willing to actually use it. Well, probably they will be willing to use it, well, maybe just before the end of the world, to save the world, because in all the other possibilities, they will not want to admit they have the backdoor. This is another question. But for sure, there could be backdoors there, from the technical point of view at least. But again, let me stress, trusted computing, all those fancy technologies, TPM, TXT, VTD, does not make it any easier to build in those backdoors. They are completely irrelevant. You could very well the same way build the backdoors into good old 386 as you can build into recent i7. Trusted computing doesn't help you build in backdoors. Yet at the same time, trusted computing protects against many other possible hardware backdoors. Okay, let me speed up because I have only 10 more minutes. So, evil DRM. This is what people fear most when trusted computing is mentioned. So, one thing that we should stress is that you don't use TXT to load a specific application like Tetris.exe or Media Player for that matter. You use TXT to load a complete system. So, you load hypervisor, and the hypervisor loads all the other components. TXT is used here, not to load Media Player. So, VMM securely loads the kernel. This is the assumption. Then the other is that the kernel securely loads the drivers, the kernel securely loads libs and services, and the kernel securely loads critical applications, like Media Player. This is a long chain of trust. Still, this could be made. But what about runtime compromise? And this is where it all falls, because where it all falls is because to maintain integrity of this whole system, including this Media Player that is at the bottom of this whole chain of trust, VMM should constantly make sure that kernel cannot be compromised at runtime. Kernel and VMM should make sure that drivers cannot be compromised at runtime. Okay, they could load the drivers securely, verify signatures and everything. That could be done. But now they should make sure that at any given time they will not get compromised by a buffer overflow or something. Kernel should make sure that library services cannot be compromised at runtime. Kernel should make sure that sensitive applications like Media Player cannot be compromised at runtime. While protecting driver compromises might be possible because we can use VTD and driver isolation, but that would mean Windows would have to switch to microkernel architecture, and I don't imagine we can expect Microsoft doing that anytime soon. But protection against runtime attacks on applications like buffer overflows is simply infeasible these days, and probably not anytime in the next 10 or 20 years. Well, people have been announcing the end of buffer overflows for a decade at least, but we see that new bugs are constantly being found. So, TXT as a protection of your core operating system? Sure. But TXT as a protection of all the applications? I don't believe it anytime soon. So, these were just three examples, EvilNight, Chinese backdoors, and DRM. Of course, there are more examples. For example, some army, or in defense systems, you have this multi-level security where you where the standards require you to have multiple computers that are air-gapped, which means physically separated from each other, and every computer is connected to different network. And this is, of course, a pain because you need to like carry a few computers with you or on a battlefield. So there are some companies that want to produce those virtual machines, offering a few virtual machines with multi-level security, and they say they use TXT to ensure the integrity of those machines, and VTD. But we don't have time for that. Finally, theory versus reality. Attacks against trusted computing. So we have hardware-based attacks and software-based attacks. Hardware-based attacks require physical access to the device, opening the case, desoldering the TPM maybe, opening the TPM. And software attacks do not require this and could be used by malware, for example. So hardware-based attacks. There's really no big deal here. You just, open TPM, and using a Microsoft, you can read some memory, maybe on this NV memory, non-volatile memory, read the keys. Or you can sniff the LPC bus. LPC bus is a very slow bus. You can sniff it with very simple electronics. There were some TPM reset attacks. You can open the case, take a metal clip, and short some connections from TPM, and this will restart TPM. Once you restarted the TPM, you can put new values to PCR registers, and you can put the original value, the desired values to PCR registers, which will cause the system thinking it is in a trusted state. But TPM getting integrated into chipsets. For example, the recent Intel ICH10 chipset does have TPM integrated. So it's much more difficult to reverse engineer the chipset, which is orders of magnitude much more integrated than the little TPM device. Plus now the attacker needs to intercept at least a DMA bus, which is at least 2 gigabytes per second. Much more expensive equipment needed. But even a successful physical attack on TPM, assuming we open TPM and extracted even secrets from TPM, doesn't automatically mean we can, for example, decrypt the disk. So we have just stolen a laptop. This laptop turns out to be encrypted with BitLocker. So we open the case, open the TPM, use microscope to read the secrets. Assuming we succeeded, still doesn't automatically mean we can decrypt the laptop, because we still need this PIN or passphrase or whatever. TPM was only used to provide trusted boot. The boot application is still required to obtain the password. So the user is required to enter the password. So at best, successful attack on TPM, when we consider, for example, this encryption, could allow for evil-made attack. That would be possible without it anyway. Software attacks. Attacks against static root of trust measurement. I'm aware of only one attempt of this, and this was a paper by Bernard Kaur in 2007. It was Oslo, Improving the Security of Trusted Computing, in which the author discussed three attacks. He found a bunch of buggy bootloader drivers that did not properly maintain the completeness of the chain of trust. This is what we discussed on this picture with this red block. When I said, what if the BIOS forgot about hashing this? In that case, it wasn't BIOS, it was bootloaders. So these were bootloaders based on group, the Linux loader, and those attacks were fixed. He also found some software-based reset attack against TPM 1.1, but not 1.2. So there was only a theoretical attack because TPM 1.1 does not provide seal or remote attestation, so the reset attack is not really a benefit, but still interesting. And finally, he found out that on his, I think, HP laptop was able to intercept BIOS core root of thread measurement, which is fatal, of course. And that was a problem of a lousy BIOS. That was in 2007, and most problems have been fixed now. And then we have attacks against digital dynamic root of trust. I think I don't have a microphone anymore. And this was presented by us. Can you hear me, or did they turn me off? I have a feeling the microphone doesn't work. Anyway, so just a few months ago, in February, we flew to Washington, D.C. and then presented attacking Intel trusted execution technology at Black Hat. This is just one slide from our presentation that illustrates the idea of the attack. This is the bootloader. This is the trusted execution technology loader, T-Boot, from Intel. This is Xen. The idea is that the T-Boot executes a center instruction and loads Xen hypervisor using TXT. And the attack works by infecting the system management mode memory, SMRAM, and then waiting in the system RAM until the Xen gets loaded in a secure, trusted way, and then infects it from the SMRAM. That sounds trivial, however, this step is significantly non-trivial, because this step requires escalation of privileges from ring zero to SMM mode. SMM mode could be thought of as something as ring minus two, because it's even more privileged than the hypervisor mode, the ring minus one, and of course much more privileged than the kernel mode, the ring zero. Normally, it's not possible for software to escalate itself to SMM mode. And of course, only if you are in the SMM mode, you can be in the SMRAM. But we have found three different attacks that allow to go into SMM mode on Intel platforms within the last 10 months. Out of those three attacks, one has been patched by Intel just after Black Hat last year. So it's August. The other one, the caching attack, that was also found by Louis Duflo, an independent person from us, is partially patched and partially not patched. So on some systems it is patched, on some it is not. And finally, the other attack we found for this very presentation has not been patched yet, but has not been published either, because we are waiting for Intel to release the patch. So the bottom line is, you can do that, but this is untrivial. But this is non-trivial. But once you escalate yourself to SMM, You can sit and wait there. You can wait for TXT to load the hypervisor, and then you can infect it from there. This is a compromise of the whole idea of TXT. TXT should not be vulnerable to this attack because TXT theoretically should not rely on the state of the system. So it should not matter that the SMM got compromised just before executing a sender. Ideally, at least how this is how TXT was advertised, no matter what we how we infected SMM or anything else, once we executed the sender, this should be loaded and protected from this kind of attacks by TXT and VDD. But it is not. So then we had this conversation with Intel after we presented the attack to them. So they say solution to TXT is called STM. STM stands for SMM Transfer Manager, which is a kind of a thin hypervisor that is supposed to sandbox system SMM code. A very crazy idea, but it theoretically solves the problem. I admit it. So we of course ask, can we take a look at this STM? So they say STM is currently not available. And they said, well, there was just no market demand yet. So is there a STM out there today? Frankly, I don't know. I haven't heard of. Yeah. And the fact is TXT is bypassable on today's systems that do not have STM. As far as I know, most systems or all systems do not have STM. Finally, launch time protection versus runtime protection. This is not really an attack. This is more of a property. So if we have a hypervisor that might have got loaded using static or dynamic root of trust, so in a trusted way, this technology only provides launch time protection. 1 second later, or 5 hours later, the hypervisor might get compromised by example, a buffer overflow executed from a VM to hypervisor, or from user mode application to kernel. It's important to realize that all those fancy technologies provide launch time protection, not runtime protection. Although it should be said that VTD can help minimize the impact of runtime protections on drivers by isolating them. So think about trusted computing as a way to provide trusted boot. And keep in mind that even that is quite a huge step forward. And finally, my message is you shall not fear TPM and TXT. They really will not forbid you from, will not prevent you from running Linux or whatever else you want. And the fact is, those technologies have potential to increase the security of desktop systems. And of course, they are cool. Also, as a challenge, this is the challenge of breaking them. And of course, there is some new stuff coming soon from our lab and this summer. Thank you very much.